you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Borzoi Boskovic back on the show. Of course, Borzoi is the co-host of The Third Rail, and also The Pause Button, which I think is making a comeback, right? Or
yeah, it's back from its hiatus.
There you go. Okay. And, well, that's carried on the rightstuff.biz. That's rightstuff.biz, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Network, if you will, or website that carries various podcasts. Recently you did a show. You were a guest, I guess, a guest host or a participant in a FTN episode, deep dive.
Yeah,
regarding Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, I'm sorry, and I kind of cut you off right there. I was just going to preface it by saying that I'm actually going to be joining them from here on out for a lot of these things. I've basically joined FTN as a part-time researcher, part-time guest host for when James is out or somebody's out, and for the deep dives.
And
we released at the end of the year. I think it was actually the start of the year. We released at the start of the year, the FTN deep dive on Alexander Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. And that show, FTN Fascination, right? That's what it's short for?
Yeah.
A lot of that is devoted to sort of these deep analysis into current affairs, and then these deep dives, which get into revisionist history, particularly American history, right? That sounds...
FTN's had an interesting evolution, because when it started out, it was... because it started out during the last election, as it was just kind of starting up after the first debate. They were devoted pretty heavily to political analysis and here's how Trump can still win, mm-hmm. kind of things going on, or here's how the establishment is making life hard for Trump. But since that bottom has kind of fallen out, and especially because what is there to say at this point that hasn't already been said? And there's only so much you can analyze with the Democratic race anyway. The show has evolved towards a much more robust style of hard-hitting topics. They've done a lot, and this is not the deep dive portion. There's been a lot of great episodes that have gone into the microfinance scheme that's going on, the way that they bring immigrants into the United States by basically putting them into a kind of debt slavery that would be astounding even to us. And other topics of, right now they just wrapped up on their regular episodes a three-part series on basically Israeli technology and how deeply invested it is, how deeply our institutions are invested in Israeli technology. But And then aside from that, they have these deep dives, which they've covered a lot of different topics, but they generally will have gone towards an American revisionism, probably the most infamous, as it were, being American coup d'etat, which took another look, another view at the Constitution. But there's also been one that's examined Reagan and Reaganomics. Mm-hmm. And the one that I have started with them on is the Alexander Hamilton one.
And that's one I think we agreed to discuss tonight. And yep. Of course, you have the deep dive. It was a two-part series into the life and legacy of Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers. his early life, his prominent role in framing of the Constitution. He was Washington's Secretary of the Treasury, the first Secretary of the Treasury of the nation. And he also was behind a key figure in the creation of the nation's first national bank. And as you go into sort of the architecture for this debt finance capitalism that we still live under today, I think his famous line was, debt is a blessing.
he called debt is a blessing because he was basing that off of how the British Empire came into prominence. It was by taking on debts, taxing spirits, and then expanding and conquering as much as the eye can see. We didn't actually cover that last aspect as much as we probably should have, because there was just so much to cover. But that was one of several reasons that fueled Hamilton's desire to conquest the rest of the continent, and also to put down any kind of rebellion that might come up from within the continent itself. I know we touched on it, though, with the way he basically meddled constantly in Adams' administration during the Quasi-War, when we almost went to war with France. The ostensible reason why Hamilton wanted to draw up the National Army, which he had just become in charge of, and march it down to they had previously been Spanish holdings, but they were now under French control, marched down there to claim them. But the real reason was to put down any kind of rebellion that would come up, because there's an army traipsing now through the lands of the people who fought for their independence, and the idea that this idea was still very, very new and very, very controversial of what this new American nation was going to be for a lot of people in this country.
Yeah, and that, of course, that vision became grim reality in the 1860s.
Yes. There's a case to be made, and it's the case that's made by Lin-Manuel Miranda in his astounding as a blockbuster musical, Hamilton, that Hamilton's kind of become the forgotten founding father for the popular imagination, really, but that he's the founding father in the sense that the country that we live in today would most, if you were to like pull all the different founding fathers together and what their vision was for the United States of America, I mean, I think you could say, like, even for all of them, we probably move far away from a lot of it. But the person it would line up with the closest would be Hamilton. He's the founding father in this case for what America has become and over time would become. And it's an interesting thing to see the way that he's basing this off of the Chernow biography. It's interesting to see how this estimation of Hamilton has changed, and they're trying to refit, because he used to be a if he had remained a British citizen, he would have been a high Tory. He was actually a very conservative, very power hungry individual who just wanted to create a new monarchy, for the most part, a new aristocracy in the United States. It's what the Federalist Party was often accused of. It's what many of their members were very sympathetic towards, but they've now, because of some of the things that he had written and some things that you can read into if you want to, they've transformed him into this abolitionist, believer in the idea of America as this nation of immigrants. There's even a line that where immigrants would get the job done. They've transformed him into this kind of modern hero, this mythologized him to the point that even historians are miffed by what they've done with this.
Serving modern day political agendas.
Yeah, and also just the way that the history is approached, it's so overboard and over the top and stretches things and well, the play itself, the musical, actually makes up a bunch of stuff. And it's actually quite egregious that because of the way that Hamilton acted during the Adams administration has absolutely zero defense for it. Like you can be the most Hamiltonian defender out there, and you would not be able to find any excuses for the way he acted during the Adams administration. The musical gets around this problem by just condensing it to a song and not talking about any of that stuff. Because even even Miranda couldn't find a way to make Hamilton out into a hero during the Adams administration, except to imply that he had to go off on Adams because Adams was mean to him and called him a Creole bastard, implying that somehow racist. There's supposed to be like an implication of racism in that. The play does some very the play is actually quite good in its technical execution. People would probably balk at the idea of the way of present that in a hip hop way. Not even get into the casting, but on a technical level, it's actually a very astounding musical. But that's where it's actually quite insidious, because it's able to take that and then start to implant these ideas easily into the minds of regular people very seamlessly.
And as you alluded to, the lead character, the actor playing Hamilton, is indeed a black man.
The funny thing is the Puerto Rican in the first running of it, because it was Lin-Manuel Miranda who originated the role of Hamilton. I think though in subsequent productions they've probably gone black. It was funny when I was actually looking into this, because we all came under the impression that all the actors were black. The majority of them are. The king is always played by a white man to make that distinction quite clear. But they actually, it's more explicitly that non-white, they just anybody who's non-white, because the woman who originated the role of Elizabeth Schuyler is half Chinese, half white. She's a Hapa, as we often call them. She was just a Hapa, and the role of Alexander Hamilton was originated by a Puerto Rican. I think they do just tend to prefer black, but it's just anybody who's not white except for the king. He's made to be white to really show that, to really make that distinct between America and Britain.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine, I haven't seen the play, but also he's clearly not the protagonist. He's the antagonist, or the bad guy, if you will, of the play.
Oh, the king?
Yeah.
Yeah. The way he's framed in the play is he never actually interacts, and this is meant to highlight his distance from America. Mm-hmm. He's never shown actually interacting with anybody else. He's never shown interacting with anybody else. He's got two or three songs that he sings solo by himself, and they're done in the style. And in contrast to the other songs, which are representative of different American styles of black music, because Jefferson's music has a much more of a has got more of like a southern kind of boogie woogie kind of rap style to it compared to some of the other ones. Like, I'm not really up on the hip hop styles, but you can tell it's a very different style. But yeah, it's the king is a white man doing Brit pop, and he is definitely the antagonist. He's portrayed as kind of more of like a possessive, obsessive stalker kind of way that you belong to me kind of style, kind of sentiments, and you'll come crawling back to me sentiments. And the last time we hear from him in the musical is that he's laughing at the idea that Americans are now, that the new American nation is tearing itself apart in its elections, and laughing at the idea of John Adams being president.
So imagine the historical treatment is something, I guess, you might get from a Schoolhouse Rock
episode. Yes, Schoolhouse Rock if it was full of lies. Because even Schoolhouse Rock had to hue as closely to the truth as possible.
Okay, well, Hamilton, of course, he was born in the West Indies. Mm-hmm. Island of Nevis, I think.
Yes.
He has sort of, a meteoric rise, but I guess you would say sort of a... we might say an unlikely rise, but again, in the deep dive, you suggest that this was sort of aided along and planned because of his ethnic connections, and I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, we were definitely reading in to this. The problem is that there's just like his early life is is that, you know, we like to smash that early life button, but it's actually hard to piece a lot of that together. And if you read biographies of Alexander Hamilton, you'll actually see them. Some of them, Chernow doesn't. Well, Chernow addresses this a little bit. Other biographies, though, will straight up address accusations that were made after the fact about his ethnic background. And even what we have, the actual stuff we can ascertain about his early life, a lot of that stuff comes from after the fact. There was actually a really good biography about Hitler by Brendan Sims called Hitler, A Global Biography. And his methodology for that was because there's been a lot of stuff that's been written about Hitler after the fact by people who knew him. And Sims said these are not reliable sources. These were all written after Hitler became a public figure. And so that view of him is going to be tainted. We need to let's stick to true primary sources written at the time that they're set in, and let's get a picture of Hitler based off of that. So he discards some sources and builds a picture of Hitler from that. Like, you get a pretty pretty good idea of many aspects of the young Hitler. If you were to do the same methodology for Alexander Hamilton, there'd be almost nothing. You just have a couple of records that he existed during this time period in the Caribbean until he got to the United States. What's there to write about down there? It's very understandable, but that's the one problem we ran into with Hamilton's early life, is that a lot of the stuff is coming after the fact, and some of it is based off of recollections that his children and grandchildren claimed that he had said. A lot of the information we know about his early life comes from his son, who wrote about him. But kind of delaying I'm leaving out like all the juicy stuff here. So there's been speculation for quite some time that Alexander Hamilton has Jewish heritage. And that question, as far as I'm concerned, is still it hasn't been resolved. I think Jazz was of the opinion that yes, he had some, or at least it doesn't really matter, because the way he acted, he might as well have some. But the story about Alexander Hamilton growing up is that because he was a bastard, he couldn't his mother could not enroll him in one of the church schools. So the only real option they had was that he had to go to a Jewish school where he learned some Hebrew. He learned how to recite the Decalogue in Hebrew, and this was supposedly something he was very proud of. Now, the thing that wasn't talked about by Hamilton was his family lineage, because he was ostensibly the son, I believe his name was James Hamilton, a Scotsman. But previous to that, and this is why he was a bastard, his mother had been married to a man named we're not sure how to pronounce it. It would look like it's pronounced Levine, L-A-V-I-E-N. And there is so much debate about that, about where that name comes from. Because if you know Jewish names, your name's immediately going to assume, like, well, that's just an alternate spelling of the Jewish name, Levine. Others, the strongest argument that she was married to a Jewish man has been that it's... Or the case that's made is that was he was a Danish Jew. Others have said that's not a Jewish, that like that spelling of it would not have been common for Jews, and there's no evidence that he was Jewish, and that there would be a little bit more, I think, because even in the records he's not listed as Jewish. So that's very debatable. But she had this very contentious relationship with this man, and she hooks up with James Hamilton and bears two children by him, but he abandons them, although he actually remained in contact most of his life off and on with his son. They were never close. They did not have I would not call their relationship a very loving or close one, but the father did acknowledge his son and did keep up with what was going on with him. But it's during this time that Hamilton is growing up in this period. He's interacting with Jews. He makes friends with Jews. He supposedly went to a Jewish school, and he's seeing the way that life is on these Caribbean islands, where there's no dignity in poverty. This is a huge theme that's going to come up throughout his life, and why some people, attitude-wise, think that Hamilton might have had Jewish ancestry, because we don't actually know if James Hamilton was his father. Some speculate that if Levine actually was a Jew, that he might actually be Hamilton's father. Some people have also speculated that Rachel, his mother, was Jewish because of the name, and Fawcett. I think it's pretty definite she came from a Huguenot family originally. But anyways, there's a lot of debate on this stuff. But it's in the Caribbean islands that Hamilton learns there's no dignity in poverty, at least not in places down there. You know, you want to be somebody who matters. You want to be wealthy. You want to be able to own slaves. You want to be able to hire servants. You want to be the master of your little domain. Like, that's how life is in the Caribbeans. And he did not have that formative experience that many Americans have, where their family, their parents come from very humble origins, and they're proud of that because they either did service to the country, or they worked hard and they did a little bit better than their parents did before, or they just have a gracefulness in their own poverty. There's no yeoman spirit in the Caribbean at all. That just doesn't exist. But that exists all over in America, and it was one of the things that really defined us. It was what led to our democratic spirit, the true democratic spirit, that Europeans who would visit were astounded by. Tocqueville, wrote very famously on that's the yeoman spirit of America. That does not exist in the Caribbean. And so Hamilton never developed any appreciation or respect or, love for that whatsoever. It was always going to end up being an obstacle to him. But he, after his mother died, he and his brother were orphaned. They ended up with a relative who also committed suicide. Ended up having a very tragic backstory that's been highlighted before as to he had the scrappiness about him. But he ends up working for, because it's been so long since I did this work, but he ends up working for a shipping company down there. And I cannot remember the name of it for the life of me. But if you look at the name of the company and trace their history, like this was a shipping company that was owned by prominent Dutch Jewish families in New York, and that was his key and access to New York later in life. There's this idea that there's this mythology about Hamilton that he wrote this beautiful poem after a hurricane wiped out everything on the island they lived on. And he wrote this beautiful poem about it, and people were so moved to tears by it. They wanted to see this young man get an education, and a hat was passed around to fund his trip to America and get him there and get him a good education. I'm doubtful that that was the intention of it. I'm sure he wrote that beautiful poem, and I'm sure there were people who wanted to donate to him for that. But he had already made connections through the shipping company. He, even as a teenager, he was practically running it in some aspects when they were away. He had just proven himself to be a very clever and hungry person. And this was somebody that they could send to New York, to where all their other connections were, and get him in there and get him higher prominence in what the British would have called the colonies at the time, because the rumblings of revolution were coming. This was coming off the heels of the 7 years of the French and Indian War, the 7 Years' War, and so there was already a lot of grumbling that was going on. People knew something was going to happen. What it was, nobody could really be sure exactly. But it's good to have your man and get him an education up there. If anything's going to happen. The Caribbean shipping, because of the tea smuggling and the like, was going to be very integral to many parts of the revolution. And Hamilton just happened to be in the United States, in the colonies, when this was all going down. He happened to be shipped up there at the right time.
I guess he attends King's College.
Yeah, he originally wanted to attend what was the one? I think he originally wanted to attend Princeton, I believe it was, and he couldn't get into that. So he ended up at King's College, which became Columbia. And that actually ended up being a better fit, where Hamilton ends up being very, very slippery. Because he's going to King's College, which, given the name going on in New York, New York's always been kind of a problem for the more rebellious colonies, because there is a rebellious spirit there, but this was always, it's not called the Empire State for nothing. But he's getting his education at King's College. He's surrounding himself and trying to social climb with people who generally have sympathies to the crown, sympathies against rebellion. And he somehow ends up to the closest man in the revolution later on. It's by the only way he could have done that is by being flexible and malleable in his views. He kind of always knew the right position to present himself with. So the way he ended up presenting himself as, and this is a guy who himself has very sympathetic to aristocracy, would love to have an aristocracy in the United States, would love to have their own monarchy in the United States. So he presents himself as like the reluctant revolutionary. And he actually does this very well for himself. He does very well for himself with this, because there's an incident that occurs where because I can't never remember the term. Well, loyalist. There's somebody who loudly speaks about being loyal, you know, being loyal to the crown. He's a loyalist, and they wanted to tar and feather this guy because that was the time period. There was a lot of, it was very heated. There was a lot of violence going on the street, on the kind of street house by house level. He stands up for this guy and helps him escape when the mob was coming after him. At least that's the story that's told. So Hamilton's able to develop this reputation for himself that as the reluctant revolutionary who defends the, you know, who but will still defend people who have a difference of opinion, which is funny when you look later on his views on free speech, not in favor of it. But he's able to be – he's very opportunist in every person he interacts with, basically looking for the angle that he needs to have with them in order to advance his career. And he's able to advance it quite handily after his studies at King's College. He's able to get into the Revolutionary Army and become Hamilton's right-hand man, and to the point that he was basically a surrogate son for – Washington, because Washington had no children of his own. And he's also able to charm the Schuyler family. Philip Schuyler has had a number of daughters, and he marries, I believe, his second oldest daughter, Elizabeth Schuyler, and is able to come into money with that. But the Schuyler family was quite charmed by this man, to the point that Elizabeth's sister, Angelica, clearly had a thing for him as well. She actually wrote a letter to her sister Elizabeth that it was actually quite funny the way she wrote it, but if they were inclined to the Roman ways, that she'd let that her sister would let her borrow him for a while, kind of thing. She was quite smitten with Hamilton, despite the fact being a married woman herself. So he's able to in the Revolutionary War, and so he doesn't really encounter a lot of conflict and opposition to himself until, I'd say, he starts dealing with the Continental Congress and he can't get everything that he wants.
And it was, I guess, his experience during the Revolutionary War. He had a good war, I guess you could say, that he sort of solidifies his reputation. This is how someone of Hamilton's, I guess, questionable pedigree would attain status in the newly, independent colonies.
Yes. And he was, it's also needs to be remembered as well, that at this time he was quite a young man. And so what does a young man of the 18th century want more than anything? To fight in a war. It's, mm-hmm. It cannot be understated how much, I mean, this is the time period when dueling was at its height. And Hamilton got himself involved in a lot of duels over his lifetime. The way that he and his friend and the people he knew tend to run their mouths, and the response to that, dueling was quite prominent. Hamilton was quite happy to engage in it and scheme within that as well. I cannot remember. He was very close with a young man from South Carolina who wanted to create the first black battalion during the Revolutionary War, and that friend of his ended up getting into a duel with General Charles Lee because of things that Charles Lee was saying about George Washington. It was a very content. They had a tendency to. there was a lot of infighting that was going on at this time, and with the friendship that the kind of friendships that Hamilton was accruing tended to be, have that same antagonism towards the way to fight the war, which is where Hamilton kept getting into his most conflicts during this time period. And that ended up being a form of social climbing himself as well, because he would write, in addition to basically fighting in a war, living a young man's dream, getting into duels and the like, he was reading vociferously on how the United States were being gestated and formed. This is where he began to come up with the idea of having this debt economy and taxing and focus towards how do you build this into an industrious country. It was a very famous book. I think it was like the Encyclopedia of Economy, I believe it was called. It was by Postlethwaite he was reading, which informed a lot of his ideas. He was also reading about the ancient who wrote about Plutarch. He was reading Plutarch. When Plutarch was writing about the various lives of ancient figures, a lot of the stuff was beginning to inform his views, and he would emerge out of that basically the man that he would be for the rest of his life. Lawrence, that by the way, like I was looking up the man that Charles Lee was dueling, and the close friend and confidant of Alexander Hamilton was John Lawrence. We didn't get into this during the deep dive because there just wasn't time and we didn't have enough time to explore this, but there's been speculation as well that there may have been a relationship between John Lawrence and Alexander Hamilton because of their unusual closeness. I mean, the thing you always have to be careful at this time, because I'm generally very suspicious. We call it the hermeneutics of gay suspicion.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm generally very suspicious of any time they try to make a historical figure out to be gay. It, obviously, yes, these things happened, but there was a way about them that they happened. But the things people tend to read into the language between men during these time periods, because men wrote in much more flowery language in general back then, but even towards one another. And I think that's kind of a consequence of the Renaissance culture that had permeated Europe, because people were bringing back these Greco-Roman kind of ways in terms of how does one be a cultured man. But it's been noted that that Lawrence and Hamilton were quite unusually close. I don't know how I feel about that, but at the same time, Hamilton's reading, he highlights a number of unusual sexual practices among the Spartans. He practically underlines this because he's reading Plutarch, and it's. I don't even know really why I'm even mentioning it. It's just that it goes to the unusual character of Alexander Hamilton, because he had this obsession, this low-key obsession with cuckolding as well, because he was basically the product of that. His mother had cuckolded another man. Mm-hmm. They were still legally married, but that's why he was a bastard. He was hung up about being a bastard. And that kind of informed his view, was a huge part of his psychological views. And it ends up being part of the reason why there's this mutual feeling between Washington and Hamilton and the surrogate father-son relationship. But that's kind of what was going on during the war. So this was for Hamilton. This was kind of the highlight of his life until he'd actually start to accrue power, because he's doing what he loves most. He loved being a soldier. That's why he was so obsessed with forming a national army that he could use to crush any potential rebellion in the United States or any other potential foreign power. He loved being a soldier so much. He loved the soldier's life. He loved everything about it. It's made him into the man that he was. All these things that I just talked about, all these things were basically going on when he was a soldier, and it made him into the man that he was.
It's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned about the letters to this guy, Lawrence. If you read the letters, Lafayette to George Washington, they strike a similar tone. But again, as you say, people wrote in these flowery languages, and you just can't ascribe modern interpretation to these things because the way people wrote back then. But
yeah, I'm trying to remember why it was that there's some evidence for why Lauren, there might have been a relationship between Lawrence and Hamilton. This is one of those things where it's like really hard. It's just, I think it's because it was even at the time it was, it's extremely, extremely hard to tell. It's just that the way that it's been presented, I've seen it presented, is that it was even over and above the way men mm-hmm. would write to each other at that time. And when Lawrence tragically died before the revolution was complete, Hamilton became a closed off man emotionally to most people. And you can take that several ways. I mean, he was his best friend. So, I mean, like, that just could have, it could have been that deeply tragic, but others take it as though, well, that's because he had a romantic relationship with this man, and that's losing him. He just was changed by that. And it was like that, like he basically put that part of his life in the past and closed all and compartmentalized all that. It's like even the Hamilton biographers are very hesitant to say anything about this. It's just like the main evidence is that he was very effusive in the way he'd speak to Lawrence.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, he lacking a father or having an absentee father might contribute to that, you know, disorientation or affliction.
Plus the person that took them in, that was supposed to raise them, at the male relative that was supposed to raise them after their mother died, the brother's mother died, killed himself. Mm-hmm. So he had his relationship with older men throughout his whole life was always, it's why like he came under the tutelage of these of this Jewish trading post in there, and why he kind of just went, why he accepted all their offers. And even when he went to New York, it wasn't just George Washington. Like he was basically always kind of falling into the orbit of anybody, of any older man who had influence.
Interesting. Yeah, you get that a lot of the in England. Like Adam Smith too was came. His father died young, and he was taken in by the oligarchs there, you know, and supported to do his work.
Did not know that.
That's sort of a pattern you see.
Yes,
of men lacking the fathers, they become tools of powerful men, and because of the psychology, they're easier to manipulate or mold because of that.
Yeah, and it's why I also ultimately don't believe that Alexander Hamilton was Jewish. So I alluded to this, but other biographies will address this, because Hamilton has come up in fascist literature in the 20th century. He mm-hmm. was Father Charles Coughlin railed against him, Ezra Pound railed against him, and they both believed that he was of Jewish origin. And one of the reasons for that was, at the time, the historiography on Hamilton was not that good. It was, especially his early life, which is what I was alluding to earlier, is that it's hard, like there's very little information that you can rely upon for his early life. So there were people who thought he was born with a name, that he was the son of Levine, and they didn't have the debate on whether that man was a Jew or not quite to the extent that they have that debate now. But view of him has permeated so much among people who study Hamilton that now biographies are beginning to address that. But the reason why I bring this all up is that the reason why I don't think he's Jewish personally, he's a Philo-Semite, but the reason why I don't think he's Jewish personally is because he happened to fall into the orbit of a people who were willing to take him in, fund his education, and give him his step up in life. And for a man that's extremely opportunistic and extremely scrappy, he also remains extremely loyal to the people who give him those opportunities, especially if there's somebody he can admire. It's why he remained close to Washington and why he lost a lot of his power once Washington's day was done. He was even the musical kind of makes fun of this fact, where Jefferson taunts him by saying, you know, when Washington calls for Hamilton, Jefferson taunts him during one of their arguments and reminds him, "Hey, Daddy's calling." He was a man who was as much as that he shaped himself, he was also shaped by the people he most admired and wanted to emulate. And he spoke admiringly of the Jews. That's why I believed he's more of a Philo-Semite than Jewish himself.
Yeah, so did Calvin Coolidge later on. So
yes, yeah, and we covered that during the, as well.
The 1781, he's at Yorktown. This is and Cornwallis is defeated, and this secures independence for the colonies. I think the Treaty of Paris is signed in 1783.
Mm-hmm.
America's independent. They come under the Articles of Confederation, and then becomes this campaign, I guess, spearheaded by Hamilton and others, to consolidate and try to centralize power in the country by. I think you addressed this in your deep dive about some financial debacles or crises that maybe he was important in creating. Crisis, you create the crisis and you present the solution. But he's behind some of these, I guess we could say, consolidation or centralization schemes. One would be the, of course, the creation of the National Bank. And some of the intrigues, or what are the interests behind that? We can get into that. Gets into Hamilton's vision. I'll let you go into this more detail on that. And also this the tax on spirits. This is all part of that plan to pay off the debt, assume the debt, then pay it off, pay off the creditors. Some people called it a bond swindle, and you can make a strong case for that. And I'll let you explain why some people view that as a bond swindle.
Yeah, feel free to jump in as well if you need to clarify or explain, because that was the hardest thing for me to have to study. I am not an economist, and I am really bad with economics. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that is the stuff's made as complicated as intentionally to make sure that people like me aren't looking into it.
Sure.
And so it's been a long time since I had to look into what this all was. But for the big thing that Hamilton wanted. So first of all, the main problem was the Articles of Confederation, which we didn't get too much into because that's basically covered in another deep dive, the American coup d'etat, about why the Articles were jettisoned in favor of a constitution, which Hamilton had a huge role in creating. People have this view of the founding fathers is like, oh, we're all in this together, guys, kind of thing. It's like, the Articles of Confederation failed, so we're going to make something stronger and we're going to do it together. That's not really what happened. There was a lot of, these were guys that were, these were all elites. These were all elites in their own way, but they were all elites with their own future of what the United States should be and what the United States could be. And the idea of the Constitution was a controversial one. The famous articles of the famous Federalist Papers that were all that if you take any advanced government class in high school, you all read this, like you all have to study them, you all have to be able to explain them briefly to your teacher. Once you realize that how alone and kind of like a single man in all this Hamilton is towards what he's trying to do with the country. Now it becomes much more astounding when you think about what the Federalist Papers are, because only three men worked on them. There were 81 papers. Only three men worked on them: John Jay, James Madison, and Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton wrote over half of them himself. He wrote 51. I believe it was 51 because John Jay only wrote. This is like to really drive home, like how much this was his baby. Because John Jay only wrote, I think, 5 Federalist Papers. The James Madison only wrote 25. So Hamilton was left to write the rest, which was already they weren't even planning to write 81, but he wrote the other 51 papers himself. And he was scheming at the Constitutional Convention with James Madison as well about the compromises that they would need to make in order to get the Constitution passed, because it was not a sure thing that it was going to pass. It was not a popular idea. And we know that it's not a it was not a popular idea because there was so much backlash to it that they had to add in the Bill of Rights. This is another thing that, because it's a complicated document to begin with, but people have a very poor understanding of the founding document of this country, the Constitution. They might briefly remember that there were people who were concerned and that's why we had the Bill of Rights, but until you understand what Hamilton was trying to do, I don't think you'll really appreciate how important then that Bill of Rights becomes, because the Bill of Rights has been the biggest encumbrance to federal power throughout the entire history of this United States government. Now, we're entering an age where it's becoming weaker and weaker to the point it's going to eventually not going to matter anyways. But it held back the government for the longest time because the idea of the Constitution was not well liked, because the reason is, and this is why we have a Supreme Court that is able to get away with the things it does, is because Hamilton intentionally wrote it to be extremely as screwy and ambivalent as it is, ambiguous as it is, so that judges could rule so that he could use the power any which way. That goes to his opportunistic nature. The document was written very vaguely in terms of the expressed powers of it, that the idea being that somebody could just assume powers because it's not explicitly forbidden in the Constitution. That's the whole reason why we have a Bill of Rights, was to guarantee our rights against that, because that's the people were not happy with this Constitution at all. There were enough people that wanted a Constitution because they just didn't want to deal with the Articles of Confederation anymore, and they wanted something different, that they were willing to go along with this. But it was not a popular document until they were able to get that Bill of Rights put in there. And the whole purpose of that he was doing this was so that he could enact the first part of the scheme that he wanted, which was the federal government needs to assume all the state's debts. This was a very difficult concept for me to understand, and I think it's a very difficult concept probably for the average person to understand, because debt economies are very complicated things, and they're very strange things when you really think about them. It's a very strange thing to have, why is the first argument this country's having is over who's owning the debts, and why would you want to own debt? Well, unless you understand how creditors work, then you realize, oh, the person who owns the debt over everybody else has all the power. They've got all the cards. They call the shots. The idea that Hamilton was presenting it as is, you can't have 13 different states, 13 different colonies that are operating like their own country, having these separate different debts, because they were in this together. Well, what's going to happen if one state bankrupts and the other one's fine? Like, you can't have a situation like that. You can't have this piecemeal system. When freedom was barely won, and there's still European, we have to remember there were still European foreign powers on the continent at this time period. That's why the Monroe Doctrine became such an important thing. It was when America was able to finally flex its will over its sphere of influence, that's when it was able to tell Europe, you are not, like, this is our sphere of influence. You are not meddling in this anymore. None of this stuff was a sure thing at the time, so there, you can understand the kind of argument that Hamilton's trying to present to people, that there's value in unity here. Unfortunately for the regular people, it's not the kind of unity that Alexander Hamilton wanted was not the kind that they wanted. But the idea, with the debt now being in the hands of the federal government, all the power would start to accrue to them. And it also accrue towards New York. There was a huge location aspect to this as well. Hamilton, being out of New York, had his own bank. That's where a lot of the banks were. And so a lot of the debt's going to flow towards New York. At the time, before the capital was moved, that's where the capital was temporarily based out of as well. So you have all the money. You have the debt being controlled in New York, you have all the power being accrued there, and you have all the money beginning to flow there.
Yeah, I believe that's where Washington is first sworn in, too.
Mm-hmm. We did not have a capital until Adams administration, until the Adams administration.
And that factors into the bank deal.
Yeah.
Because Washington agrees to it, the capital being located in the South, if they allow, I think this is how it went down. Technically in the South, you know, Maryland and Virginia, it was considered the South, and Of course, that was right adjacent to Washington's property. And then
we don't actually know how it went down because Hamilton, because when Jefferson came back from, so I'm going to, let me just go in a couple more details and I'll, I'll talk about the compromise. Making this deal, I'm trying to remember what the exact deal that, because this actually feeds into the compromise we're going to talk about. I think the compromise that I'm referring to is the compromise of 1790. The compromise of 1790. Yes, it is the compromise of 1790.
This creates a deductive of implied powers too, right?
Yes, I believe so. I'm just trying to remember like the full. So the compromise of 1790 comes on the heels of the, basically. I now I remember what it was. So during the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton and Madison basically agreed that the federal government's going to assume the state debts, and that was part of how they were able to get enough people on board to get this constitution to pass, and this was going to be the plan. At some point, though, Madison didn't want to do, they end up going back on this, and I suspect I wonder. And the thing is, like, we just don't know a lot of the stuff. We just don't know. It's speculation. I suspect it might have been because of the way that the whole thing with the IOUs and the soldiers was handled, because that was a big thing that kind of led to some of the first splits. So there was
the Newburgh crisis.
I think it might have been the Newburgh. The Newburgh crisis, I think, might have come out of that. I'm trying to remember the exact
unpaid pensions or salaries to soldiers, and there was a talk of a coup, and Washington went there and gave his speech.
Yeah, it's. No, the Newburgh conspiracy was part of the many problems that this new country was having, because a part of when they, alongside the federal government assuming the state debts, there was controversy of who the United States, basically the government decided they were going to honor the IOUs. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of IOUs were issued during the revolution, and a lot of people, there was no guarantee that these were ever going to get paid, and so a lot of soldiers, a lot of people ended up selling off their IOUs because they were desperate for money. And now the government said that they were going to honor the, now that the government had money, they were going to honor those IOUs. They were going to, and that there were people who thought that was BS, that people who were basically vultures, people who had preyed on other people's misery, were going to get the compensation that should have gone to the people that had taken on the IOU in the first place, the people who had given the actual money for the revolution. And there was a huge debate on this, because here's the problem. If you want to be legal about this, it's like, well, the person who bought the IOU deserves to be paid for that, because they bought it expecting they didn't buy it just as a charity. They bought it because they expected to be paid. But you're talking about people who fought and bled for this country, and to not have them compensated in any way was an incredibly, like, just what does that say about the country? Like, that you're favoring these bankers over the people who actually fought and bled for it, the people who went bankrupt.
Well, these creditors didn't matter.
Yeah, it's,
they weren't too big to fail.
And I can't remember if that's what may have.
Well, I think how it worked out is how it suggested, and I read about this. The scandal part of it is this is all part of the assumption and discrimination question.
Yes,
who pays? Who gets paid? And the idea of assuming the state debts and imposing an excise tax, and then making good on those bonds in specie, meaning gold and silver. Yeah. As opposed to paper money. The people who were holding these bonds were desperate, and so agents of Hamilton, I think Robert Morris,
yes,
from New York,
Morris. It was Morris.
Who knew that Congress was going to pass this, the people didn't know. So they had inside information. This is the same old story. So they went out and bought these things for pennies on the dollar, if you will, knowing that they would be redeemed in full when they pass the assumption tax, and then they go turn around and they impose these taxes on spirits, which is an attack on the culture. And I think you get into this in the talk, and for many people this is a form of currency, whiskey. They tax whiskey, so the very people who got ripped off, many of the people got ripped off selling the bonds, not knowing inside information, then are turned around and taxed to make good on the bonds they were sold without that information. That's so many people interpret it as a swindle, insider dealing and everything.
Yeah. And apologies to the listeners because my timeline is being a bit wonky here. What I'm trying to illustrate is the early part of the United States was all about these little schemes with Hamilton. And
it's America's really, aspiring oligarchy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's and what the early battles of this country were was like, where's the money? Where's the money and power going to go to? So you have this. And so a lot of these problems are pretty much converging with the IOUs. Mm-hmm. It was the assumption crisis. I couldn't remember the term. So, yeah, that's what it was. It was assumption as well as the state debt thing. So at some point, Madison goes back on the idea of the state debts going to the federal government. Virginia and Jefferson probably had a large part in that as well because Jefferson had just come back. Jefferson missed most of the 1780s. He was ambassador to France. Mm-hmm. So he comes back into this mess and basically leads like kind of a Jeffersonian revolt against what's going on. And this is where the Compromise of 1790 comes into play because they were not going. He was not going. Hamilton was not going to get the votes for the government to take over and pay the state debts. So what he, and this is where we actually don't know what was said. All we know is that Hamilton, Jefferson, and Madison had a dinner together because these were the guys that were in. Well, Madison was the Speaker of the House at the time. And then Hamilton and Jefferson were in Washington's cabinet, and Hamilton and Jefferson had a very acrimonious relationship in Washington's cabinet. They fought constantly.
So the point at this time there are no political parties. This is what forges political parties. This controversy.
Yes. Yeah. This is where the Democratic Republicans are basically born because Jefferson is serving as Secretary of State, Hamilton serving as Secretary of Treasury, and these are the two most important positions in any administration at the time is State and Treasury, and because these are the first State and Treasury positions that have ever been filled, you're having what the scope and vision of these offices are being forged by these very men, and Jefferson ended up kind of working as a counterweight to Hamilton because he was basically opposed to almost all of the things that Hamilton was trying to do or what Hamilton wanted. But because Hamilton could not get the votes that he needed for – and this would have put his position in jeopardy because if he cannot get his first thing through, then what power does he even have? Like what's the why have him as treasurer if everything he's going to do is going to get voted down? He needs a first vote in order to set the tone for the rest of the administration and for him to pursue any other policies he wants to pursue. This is where we don't know much about what happened. A lot of this happened behind closed doors. Hamilton, Jefferson, and Madison meet to have a dinner, and they come up with this was part of the assumption thing. So this all was kind of happening at the same time. Pulling up some of my old notes on this. So the compromise that they come up with is that Madison would obtain the national capital in the South because it was Jefferson that ended up brokering this compromise. Madison and Jefferson would get the capital in the South, and Hamilton would get his laws passed.
That's Madison's way of keeping Washington from becoming too corrupt.
Yep. Well, yeah. It's,
how'd that work out?
Yeah, I mean, it actually made sense at the time.
It did, yeah, yeah.
Moving having the capital in the North just solidified that's where all the power and money was. And it's because the capital was moved down to the South, that's because we have to remember, like, the South is always, by population-wise, by the white population, was always a much smaller region than the North. It's always been, like, by any kind of metric, I think. Well, it's actually that's hard to say. I'm not exactly sure when that population would kind of flip because the problem is like you have Virginia and you have all these slaves and that played a part with like the Three-Fifths Compromise and that. But the South has always kind of been weaker to the North in many different respects by moving because it wasn't going to have that financial power. By moving the capital to Virginia, that has always given the Southerners more of a say in the United States and in government, and it's what kind of gave them the gave them some of the strength they'd be able to have to stay, you know, to have the Civil War, to rebel. And I don't know if that would have been possible to the extent if the Capitol had been in the North, if the Capitol had remained like in Philadelphia or New York City, mm-hmm. because it's just power and money would have just been much more tightly accrued up there. But this compromise is brokered, and Jefferson regretted this. He considered this one of the worst things he'd ever done, and we don't. Again, they did not talk about what happened behind the scenes, but because in the end, even though the Southerners got the capital, in the long run, it doesn't matter compared to financial power. Mm-hmm. And by making this compromise, they handed over. By handing these state debts over to the federal government, they kind of sealed their fate. They handed this ultimate power, this final power, this final say over to the federal government and laid the groundwork for the implied powers.
Yeah, which is basically it nullifies the idea of specific and enumerated powers. If under necessary and proper or implied powers or general welfare, you can do whatever, which is how the courts have justified all the usurpations and expansion of federal power without the benefit of any amendments, you know, in the last, you know, 150, 200 years, you know.
Yeah. The funny thing is that despite the fact that Jefferson regretted this, it's more or less what created the system that allowed Jefferson to use to be able to make the Louisiana Purchase.
Yes, yeah.
we're actually planning on doing a Jefferson deep dive. I don't know if that's going to be the next one.
A proto-libertarian elected president.
He
also doubled the size of the army too because of the Embargo Act and all that.
Yeah, he's an interesting figure because when he doesn't have power, he's staging these rebellions of sort against the kind of things that Hamilton's doing. But like when he assumes power, he ends up using a lot of stuff because they have it now, and there's probably no going back. Just as a side note, I'm going to be heavily researching the Sally Hemings question because I actually got into a debate with Jazz about that because he's of the opinion that Sally Hemings' children weren't Jefferson's. I'm of the opinion they were, but that's a completely separate issue. I don't think you want to get into that right now, but just a little teaser for people. Like that's Jazz and I are going to be having a debate on that in a future deep dive.
The Sally Hemings question. Now, of course, the National Bank, the Assumption, and the Whiskey Rebellion, Hamilton's role in these things. The idea behind this, again, is solidifying the nation, tying the creditors, the money class, to a national government was key in his vision in building this empire. And to do this, he needed something like the National Bank, and we can talk about how it was capitalized initially and what its effects were and the political divisions it created. The final analysis is these tools, if you will, or institutions are important in bringing forth the Hamiltonian vision of the country and sort of shunting aside the Jeffersonian vision, the anti-federalist position, which technically sort of won the day in the Constitution.
I don't think I think that there's flashes of Jeffersonian rebellion that's, you know, within the American spirit, but Hamiltonian, I mean, if the question was still up in the air in the 19th century, that question was decisively answered at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865. Mm-hmm. That put the final that sealed the letter and put the wax on it for good, as far as I'm concerned. And this is we're giving out a lot of dry information on this. And we're trying to summarize very complex things as best as we can. But what I would recommend for people is this is important stuff to understand and look into, because it's, if you're an American, this is our history. And we've gotten flack on these deep dives because we are going very revisionist on what the vision of America is. And this, for people who want to be American nationalists, these are the problems you have to contend with, because if the people in power had had any sympathies for the regular people like us, then you could merge those two ideas together. Like, it's okay, we have a bit of a we have a powerful federal government, and we have this mixed feelings on that, but this is a government that actually views the people as its people. You can merge a nationalism into that. You can't merge a nationalism, though, where the people in power are hostile and hate the founding stock of this country.
Well, it's part of their business plan to destroy it.
Yeah. So if you're an American nationalist, you are a nationalist for the founding stock of this country. But the people who created the government, because we have a Republican government, small r Republican government, we're in a very unique situation as a people, because we're one of the few people, I think, that's really taught to have a civic pride and have this pride in why one form of government, this is not the only form of government we had, why one form of our government, we need to practically worship it. And and the thing is, like, a lot of the symbols that American nationalists want to claim are symbols of the United States government, of a government that hates you, despises you, wants to destroy you and displace you and dispossess you. So that's like that's the conundrum of American nationalism. And traditional Catholics have very similar issues as well, because you have the heresy of Americanism, but also because of very well known trad Cath talking point that it's America was a Protestant Masonic government.
Yes.
As a Catholic, you cannot be for many traditional Catholics, and there were a lot of Catholics who were Americanized, so they feel like they've squared the circle on that. For many traditionalist Catholics, and this has always been a problem in this nation's history, they do not see it as possible to be a Catholic and American nationalist. But that's a completely separate question. For me, what I'm putting out there for people, that's a completely different discussion. What I'm putting out there for people is, like, it's very important to question everything that you've been taught and actually read the history on this. And when you read the history on this, the thing that keeps coming up is, like, do you feel affinity for this? Like, do you actually feel affinity for this founding father? Do you, like, when you read about how Alexander Hamilton was and what he wanted to do to this country, do you hold any affection for him for as a founding father? And you'll find, like, this happens a lot with many of the founding fathers. Like, these people didn't care about my people one bit. And that gets into the whole whiskey rebellion, because, as you said, whiskey was a kind of currency. It was also a cultural practice. Moonshine was Western Pennsylvania wasn't really having, gunfights at the OK Corral and High Noon and stepping out and Clint Eastwoods of the world with their ponchos and, like, instead of, like, that kind of Hollywood Wild West, the Wild West of Pennsylvania was mountain folk who had created their own way of life out in the hinterlands, out in the borderlands, out in the wilderness, and they had their own currency and their own cultural practices had managed to get itself outside the jurisdiction of actual government power.
So they weren't even getting any benefit of government either.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was very hard for legal authorities to arrest people and to charge them with crimes, because these people would fight them. I think it's called Christiana in Copenhagen. It's like this little neighborhood in Copenhagen, Denmark, which is like this autonomous anarchist community. It's just a drug den.
Yeah.
But because it's so independent and resists all authority whatsoever, it's ungovernable. It's basically left alone and just contained because it's just completely ungovernable. And now these Scots-Irish Appalachian moonshining folks, I wouldn't call them like anarchists or anything like that, but they had their own ways, and they didn't want outsiders telling them what to do. And they were quite content to make sure they knew that, like, you're not going to tell us what to do. And that was a big component of why the whiskey rebellion even happened in the first place. Like, they were targeted. They were explicitly targeted for that reason, because the theme of Hamilton here is that Everything needs to be under the central authority, and you cannot govern a place where you're constantly having to put down rebellions. We have to remember as well that at the time that the forefathers like Hamilton knew the history of Britain, and it would have been fresh in people. I mean, the English Civil War and all the problems that came from that was only 100 years before. The way that we talk about the Civil War would have been the way that these people talk about the English Civil Wars. All the problems that came out of that were well known to people. And so for somebody like Hamilton, you cannot have a situation like that where you're constantly dealing with a fractious group of people that keep separating, want to do their own thing, and will fight you if you try to institute any kind of power and order over them. So it kind of worked hand in hand with this, where in order for the British Empire to build their empire, the first thing they did was, after they take on the debt, is they put excise taxes on the spirits. So Hamilton convinced the government to follow this plan as well. And he wrote this all out in the report on credit, or the big document he wrote when he became it was the report on public credit, which was a major report in and economic policy he wrote and submitted when he became the United States
Secretary of Treasury. Well, it's interesting. In England, the tax on spirits resulted in a consolidation of refiners, right? I mean, or what do you call them?
Oh, spirit distillers.
Distillers. That's the term I'm looking for. Distillers. It did in this into larger companies that could cope with the regulation and the taxes, and this tends toward greater control from the central power. And that was part of the objective of the tax on whiskey, was to lead to that very same consolidation. Because at the time, you want all these yeoman farmers, independent people, fractious people becoming, not being able to compete, so they eventually become wage earners, wage slaves, as opposed to independent farmers and these things. And same with the smaller companies. And I guess there was their plan that the excise tax would have a similar effect. And at the same time, I was reading a comment on it about it, how, obviously the tax never collected much money, but the point was made when the armies went in and crushed it. And the tax wasn't so much paid as it was evaded. But as I think George Washington said, that federal power was vindicated and the example had been set, which is the important part.
Yes. I can't remember where he wrote this part. I think it was on the Republic report on public credit. But Hamilton knew what was going to happen as a result of this. He was a smart man, and he, in fact, like we've talked about before, like he liked to engineer crises that he could then solve with his own solutions. This was one of them, and he knew. I mean, like I said, the mountain men, the hill men of Western Pennsylvania were targeted specifically. They were specifically targeted because this would be the best test of federal power, because he knew these were going to be the people that got the most upset about it.
And this goes back to your observation about him growing up in the Caribbean, his contempt for labor, poverty, and the idea that this was a form of psychology. So when he is in power, seeking power, and trying to fulfill his vision of what the U.S. Would be, United States would be, he's not going to have much sympathy for these guys.
Yeah. No, anyway. Not at all.
Yeah.
He has no sympathy for the yeoman. And so when he knew this was going to happen, he basically was egging on – Washington this whole time. He knew this was going to be the way to prosperity, but he knew there was going to be opposition to this. And he outlined that the way to deal with this is basically you need to crush these people with overwhelming force and power. And he outlined all he wanted to turn it, basically give police state powers over to the inspectors who would need to go to these distilleries. And it's quite astounding the level at which he wanted to give these guys power to crush this. But this becomes just a theme of the rest of his career, of how he wants to crush, whether it's on a personal level or a social level, he wants to crush his enemies, or what he perceives to be his enemies, totally and completely. There's just no room for anybody to ever strike back, the way that Hamilton views this. There's no compassion in the way he wants to approach this. So he, when the whiskey rebellion came up, he was all in favor of, like, call up as many troops as we can and just crush them. Just if we have to kill a bunch of them, that's what's going to happen. They're not going to stand down. Now, thankfully, the situation was able to be diffused by cooler heads and people who were not Hamilton, basically. But that was the whole reason for the Whiskey Rebellion. Like it was Hamilton was very adept at basically he did something for one reason, but it was really for another reason. And if he did it right, he got both in the end, anyways. So he's doing this because he wants the prosperity that they're going to get and the centralization they're going to get from taxing spirits. But he knew a rebellion was going to result from this, and so that would allow it, because he wanted to build a national army. This could serve as the basis for that, by engineering a rebellion that would necessitate creating a national army, especially if the rebellion starts to spread, and then because it would get out of control, you crush them totally and completely. Now power has been accrued quite a bit. This is a theme in the this is why you can tell that the Constitution is Hamilton's baby, because of the implied powers problem. Whenever something comes up and there's no clear answer as to what the federal government can do, because of the way the Constitution is written, it's like, well, it's just going to assume that from now on, and it's going to assume that now for the entire future. There's no real built-in restraint to that, but you don't know it's an issue until the issue comes up at all, and that's where the power of the Supreme Court comes in, and why it's able to legislate these laws. Because crisis is created, we don't know where the powers lie. Then, you know, if you're somebody like Hamilton, you've used your influence to pack the courts with your people, and they get to decide what your powers are. And that's why it was inevitable that the Supreme Court was going to become like, – it's hilarious to me when I see regular people bemoan the fact that the bench is – it's partisan. It was always going to be partisan. It was designed to be partisan. It was designed basically for whoever could get them on the bench to uphold whatever powers they wanted to have. But yeah, I don't know. Go ahead.
At the time, again, the Supreme Court's powers weren't judicial review wasn't in the Constitution. That's all part of implied powers. Yeah. John Marshall does it in Marbury versus Madison. And then he also subsequently, I think it was McCulloch v. Maryland, when he opposed the constitutionality of the National Bank under the doctrine of implied powers. There are different attitudes. I think Jefferson had the idea of concurrent review, whereas as the Congress and the president could also interpret the Constitution, which seems to make sense. And what you'd have sort of this rough constitutional politics being played out. There was no final arbiter, because the final arbiter is ultimately arbitrary and very political, as we see. There's a great summation explaining the tax on whiskey, the excise tax on spirits. I think it's Hoagland's book on the Whiskey Rebellion. He wrote, and this kind of laid out sort of how it distorted the economy in favor of finance and concentrated industry, as mm-hmm. opposed to regional or local economies developing on their own, which would be a roadblock or would stymie Hamilton's vision of a centralized economy. He says, with a value nearing the absolute, it might vary by region, but given countryside appetites, couldn't depreciate whiskey become currency? I'm sorry, depreciate whiskey become currency in places where coin wasn't seen. Barter paralyzed local economies, but whiskey was a true medium, always exchangeable for cash somewhere down the line, thus maintaining value against metal, a liquid commodity both literally and figuratively. The drink democratized local economies, offering even tenants and sharecropping laborers a benefit. Tenants often wanted to pay rent, and laborers often got paid in a portion of the grain they harvested. Community stills transformed for a cut such cumbersome forms of payment into something fungible. And while landlords often refused in-kind crops or demanded them in extravagant quantities, they'd take whiskey for rent. The product connected popular finance theories with small-scale commercial development that, though marginal, had potential to free rural people of debt and dependency.
And at the same time that this is going on, Hamilton's trying to bring over British manufacturers to America. So these things go hand in hand with each other. He's wanting to, you know, that's the other aspect. He's wanting to crush that local economy so that it's now on, so that they can't be independent of the economy that he wants to create. I sound, when I'm talking about the way that Hamilton waits for, you know, engineered this the Constitution to basically be able to be used however you needed to be used when a crisis occurs. I almost sound like conspiratorial the way I say it, but the thing that people have to also understand is that Hamilton had very clear presidential designs, and this, like, all of the stuff was, and him being in the way he served under Washington was basically him training to one day take the presidency, because, and that he even made sure, like, the Constitution was ambiguous on the whole immigrant question because of his status as well. Mm-hmm. And it was only because of the Reynolds affair that, and all, well, the Reynolds affair was the main one, but it's also like he overextended himself and made a lot of enemies to the point that people were getting wise to a lot of things he was doing. It was only because of all that that his presidential ambitions were dashed before he could begin his first run. But this is, you can imagine, if he had plenty of years left to live before he died in that 1804 duel. If he, like, let's say the Reynolds affair never happened and he's able to win the presidency, like, you can only imagine like the way he would have tried to, because like we've seen the way he tried to wield power when he was just a cabinet member or just an advisor, when he's got actual power, you can just imagine the way he would have, the amount of court cases he would have ended up in. And he was, you know, I mean, he probably wouldn't have argued for his own case at the Supreme Court level, but he was a lawyer himself. He would have definitely been advising on the legal arguments. He was a frighteningly ambitious man.
He seemed to be more effective working just behind the scenes, though.
Yeah, I think it's just because that's where his Achilles heel was, because he was a brash, easily angered man. Mm-hmm. If he had much more mastery over his emotions and was much better about his schemes, he could have positioned himself better where he didn't make so many enemies over his lifetime. His love of us insulting people, I think the main thing was him using his newspapers to insult people, which he did ever since he was in the Revolutionary, like even while he was in the Revolutionary War, he's writing anonymously in his own in newspapers and then later his own newspapers to basically trash and slander his or libel his anyone who basically crossed him, and people got wise to that. People became aware, like, this is Hamilton, like, this is, because he loved writing anonymously, and people got wise to that was Hamilton doing that. If he was able to rein that in, he probably, and play the long game a little bit better, he would have been in a better position to seek power if that's what he wanted. I think he ended up having to become comfortable with being constantly behind the scenes because he just shot himself in the foot too many times.
And I guess this was leads to his actual physical demise, because the duel with Aaron Burr in 1804 is a result of some sort of intemperate or insult or something. And
yeah. Oh, he brought that upon it. Now, and actually James made the case during the deep dive that he the way he conducted himself was because he didn't have he didn't have much to live for at that point, which is why I was talking about, like, if he had become president, how frightening he would have been, because his career had nowhere else to go. All he could do was meddle behind the scenes now, because the Reynolds scandal and everything else he had done had tarnished his reputation, and the federal, like, he was causing rifts within his own party, the Federalist Party, because there was conflict between the Hamiltonian Federalists and the John Adams Federalists. He had created all these problems that he had no political future. Basically, his first son had died in, I think it was his first son, but his son Philip Hamilton had died in a duel 3 years prior. In fact, actually in the same spot where Hamilton would be shot. His son had been shot there, and there was really nowhere else for him to go at that point. He was a dejected man who had his public reputation just completely ruined, and it seemed like, I don't know. I think it's hard. This is where it gets to speculation. I think and because of the way he treated slights, like everything that Aaron Burr did, like was to Hamilton a series of slights over time, running against his father-in-law for the Senate seat, but mainly making a competing bank mm-hmm. in the in New York, and then the whole thing with the vice presidency had put him into constant conflict with this man that it was. Hamilton could have avoided his death, but I think he did. He just didn't care at that point. Go ahead.
It was Hamilton who worked behind the scenes, I guess, in Congress to secure the presidency for Jefferson over Burr. I think at the time, you just voted for the ticket. Whoever got the most electoral votes became president. The person who got the second most became vice president, and there was a tie. And Hamilton worked, I think, in the House of Representatives to secure... even though he didn't like Jefferson, he hated Burr more. And this kind of set the stage. And this is in 1801 for this, this duel. Because they had been rivals, or not rivals, but just like opponents of each other going back into the 1790s. So
yeah, they had been in each other's sphere for quite some time. And Burr, I believe, had been a Federalist before switching over to a Democratic Republican, which I think that might have been the other. There's a number of reasons, like, why did Hamilton hate Burr so much? Like, why did this one man in particular infuriate Hamilton so much? There's the running against his father-in-law. There's the mm-hmm. bank. I believe Burr had been a Federalist and then became a Democratic Republican. Aaron Burr was not a man of many convictions. Although he's actually an interesting figure in his own right. When we did the deep dive, this is what I learned after the fact. He was the grandson of Jonathan Edwards. Sinners in the hands of an angry God through his maternal line. He was the grandson of the Jonathan Edwards. He came from this very prestigious Congregationalist line. I can't remember. His family was deeply involved in Princeton. And so there's that other rivalry aspect between Burr and Hamilton, Princeton versus Columbia, King's mm-hmm. College. But it's very the hatred that Hamilton had for Burr is very, to me, very, very unusual, because it's not as though Hamilton's a man of convictions. I mean, I guess if his conviction is absolute power, then yes, he is a man of conviction.
Yeah.
But the way that this historical episode between the two is often depicted is that Hamilton's making a stand against, you know, that Burr is dangerous because he has no convictions and you don't know what this man wants or desires. But it's like, is that really any different from you, Hamilton? It's the only thing is, like, you just make it clear that you desire power.
Yeah, I think in the show you quit, it's like Paul Ryan having a duel with
there's a tendency towards absolutist thinking in the online right, where it's like because you grow to hate one person, then you just assume anybody who opposes that person must be based in red build.
Yeah.
So it's like, because we were joking that Aaron Burr did nothing wrong, and that, we only say that just because Hamilton got everything that was coming to him.
It makes for a good bumper sticker.
Yeah. But Aaron Burr is not an interesting figure, but he's.
Well, it's
He's
interesting. He was a sitting vice president, and he shoots Alexander Hamilton, and he serves out his term as vice president.
Yeah, that's actually. I didn't get into that on the show, but it was really funny because he served out his term, and his farewell speech. Okay, I this is so funny to me. His farewell speech moved his colleagues to tears, and he was hated. Uh-huh. Aaron Burr was a hated man, but his farewell speech moved people to tears. And to put this into context for people, he shot and killed a man. This would literally be like, it's 2008 it's 2008, it's the end of the year, or right before, or it's 2009, right before the new Obama's term starts, and let's say Cheney actually killed his friend. And Cheney gives a farewell speech that moves the people in Congress to tears. That is a surreal, weird thing. Now, at the time, like, duels were a lot more common. So, yeah. But like, your vice president killed a man.
Yeah,
not only did he kill a man, he killed he killed the man who basically created the Constitution alongside James Madison.
Then he has
it's a very weird thing to think about.
Then he goes off and tries to like form his own little country. Then he's I guess he's acquitted of that or proven.
I would love to do a deep dive into Aaron Burr because he's just like he's a weird and interesting figure, very tragic life as well because he lost his wife and daughter before he passed, and he was very doting on his daughter. He was actually a proto feminist in many ways, mm-hmm. That's actually a result of his Congregationalist heritage. For people who don't know, the Congregationalists were descended from the Puritans. Jonathan Edwards, from the line of Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards' daughter, Aaron Burr's mother, was noted to be one of the most intelligent women probably of her time period, and he had a deep respect for women's education. Aaron Burr did a lot to give his daughter a very prestigious education and well-rounded education as well. Very unusual figure for his time. And I think that's a result of the Puritanism he was descended from, because Puritanism is it's often derided, and rightfully so, but it has these unique things about it that are part of the American character, such as the sense of equality, which many of our own are going to bristle at, but it shaped a lot of this country. Yeah, it's a very intriguing heritage.
Yeah, the Puritans became the Yankees and sort of the self-righteous missionary, going these crusades for justice. If you read the Battle Hymn of the Republic, that's very.
I kind of claim this as my own, but I actually got this from Nick Mason. This is why Moby Dick is the great American novel, at least the great American novel, what America used to be, because of the themes of Quakerism are so prevalent, mm-hmm. in that, and Quakers have a similar pedigree to the Puritans. The way Nick Mason described it is, Moby Dick, the Pequod is America, because the Pequod is a ship full of colored savages following insane Quakers on doomed and tragic quests.
Yes.
And I've never heard a more apt description of America, to be honest. It's my favorite description I've ever heard of my country.
And I think these are the Puritan churches, they're the ones now with all the rainbow flags out front saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's I don't know where I had it quoted to me by somebody, but now I feel like you search this phrase, like I'm the one who comes up for it. But in one of my essays, I had said that Harvard was built to train the Puritan clergy. It never stopped.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's just it's still just as religious, really. It's just And it is pointing out that the Puritans themselves were very philo-Semitic. They had their own tikkun olam, mm-hmm. outlook on things. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No. The I know we're going off on a tangent, but I think this is some interesting stuff here. The there was a this is always fascinating. Like I talked a bit about the stuff in the in my humiliation essay, the Feast of Shame. I covered a bit of the history of Puritanism because some of our views on humiliation were shaped by the Puritans.
Has that been published yet?
Oh yeah, no, it's on American Sun. Just
it is.
Yep, theamericansun.com. That's why I was surprised you didn't want to talk about it. It's like,
I was kind of curious. I was just casually looking for it. Was able to find it. If I go to American Sun, I can find it.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's on American Sun. It was published on January 1st.
Oh okay, yeah, I'd like to read that and talk about that sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can come back on.
I'll take a look for it. So
there was a. During the Commonwealth period of England, what do they call it? I think they're called the Fifth Monarchists. Yes, the Fifth Monarchists. There was, if you thought the Puritans were insane as they were already, the Fifth Monarchists were the extreme of the extreme. They were an apocalyptic Puritan group that wanted to bring about the end times,
mm-hmm.
but one thing that they would call themselves was the Sanhedrin.
Yes.
Yes. I get into arguments all the time with Anglophiles about this period of English history because Cromwell helped crack open the door a bit for the Jews to come back into England.
He reversed the decision of 1290. Yeah.
Yeah, and but it was like they really came back with William the First, or not first, William the Third. They really came back with William the Third because he was bankrolled. His army, his military was bankrolled by a Dutch Jew. But yeah, unfortunately, that's we are descended. This country was built in a large part by that stock of people with those Philo-Semitic tendencies, which is. Been one of the internal conflicts of the United States from the start. It's why we've had Jews from the start in this country, Dutch Jews mainly, originally in New York, but it's why we've always had Jews from the start in this country.
And being a pluralistic, liberal society with many vectors for infiltration and manipulation, we've seen that.
Which Hamilton admired about, I guess to get back on track, which is what Hamilton admired about America and wanted to like help shape America into. He was this weird, his vision for it was kind of this weird, which is why I think it's the America now. It's this weird meritocratic, but aristocratic, finance capital nation.
But he coined I think he coined the term American system, which was picked up by the Whigs and Henry Clay and Lincoln. And,
yep.
I mean, it's interesting you mention that because, we can maybe, as we close off, we get an hour and a half now, but, Hamilton, his vision, he cast a long shadow, is that our system is the Hamiltonian system. In fact, perhaps reading into reductio ad absurdum at this point now, but, Ben Bernanke, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve a while back, penned this about Hamilton. Hamilton was without doubt the best and most foresighted economic policymaker in U.S. history. And it was our current Federal Reserve system is his vision. And the Federal Reserve system has its own history and intrigues how it was created, 140 some years later after the First National Bank. But we can talk about the current American system, what America's become. Mm-hmm. Was it inevitable with this Hamiltonian system? And if you look at today, $22 trillion debt, we're very blessed today. We're very blessed.
It's a blessing.
Student debt, crushing student debt, compounded interest, usury. And we see that debt as a weapon, how it's basically, it's a way that you can manipulate an economy. And I think you talked about this, the debt-based economy is sort of a cancerous economy because you need uncontrolled perpetual growth because you got to make the interest payments.
you have to keep, this kind of economy is the complete, because when you have an economy like this, all that matters is the lines and the numbers. There's no actual heart to that, so it becomes an organism in and of itself, and thus it is subject to the one cardinal rule of nature: if you're not growing, you're dying. And that's so debt has to constantly be expanding, and it constantly has to be finding new customers and new bases for it to plant itself in order to keep growing and in order to keep thriving. Because once it stops growing, it begins to die. This is a common thing you're going to see. The only way that economies don't fall into this is when there's a heart to it where it's able to sustain itself one way or the other, internally. And one thing I was going to say as well about the whole Jeffersonian versus Hamiltonian thing is that anyone with powers going to be Hamiltonian. The only Jeffersonians in this country are powerless yeomen who like to read history. Those are the only what remains of the yeoman. To me, that's the true American. What remains of the true of the yeoman spirit of this country is the last of the true Americans, basically. And to answer your question,
Jefferson in power, you could say, was the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, exactly. This has always been the libertarian power. This has actually always been a liberal problem as well. All forms of liberalism are about negation, and they create so many power vacuums that's why the liberal either becomes a tyrant or it becomes a no, or he becomes like, who cares? Like, no, nobody's listening to you. Nobody's giving you power. Like, it can only go in one of two directions. That's the way liberalism functions.
Is this an outgrowth, inevitable of the sort of the destruction of the feudal order, and the rise of capitalism in the wake of the Protestant Reformation or Revolution, if you will.
This definitely sort of a rise, definitely part of capitalism. This is actually something Carl Schmitt noted as well, because that's why his liberalism, like, you can't really separate it from liberal capitalism. It is liberal capitalism. You could ostensibly. This gets into kind of like the problems of liberalism. You could ostensibly have liberal aspects of a society, but you can't have a liberalism be the foundation of that society. You can inject liberal, whatever people think about that. You can inject liberalism into different aspects and still have a functioning country with a core identity that doesn't have that problem of constant need for expansion and to expand. Because liberalism is basically a negation. Liberalism is basically nothing. It has to cover the entire earth in order for it to persist and to perpetuate itself, because all it takes is for something more powerful than it, something that's more cohesive to, take a North Korea, for instance. May not be the society a lot of people would want to live in, but as an autocratic society, it retains a sense of itself, and it's not privy to the way liberalism functions because it, for now, keeps it out. Because as long as North Korea exists, it serves as a reminder to people that there are other ways that people can live and retain their sense of selves. Liberalism just cannot allow for that, and that's a consequence of liberal capitalism, because it turns it takes the humanity out of man and turns them into an economic unit. Mm-hmm. And I've heard people in my own family say, like, kind of refer to it in the, like, you know, what's most important is, like, you know, like, all that, the only color that matters is green, kind of thing. It reduces all these complexities of being human to being an economicus, and that's, I mean. I don't think you're going to find a lot of people that are in favor, are going to be actually in favor of that, unless they're the one that are making bank on it. But a lot of people, because they've been so weakened by that, by these philosophical ideas and this liberal culture, they're afraid to think of anything that's an alternative because it might entail being mean to some people.
Yeah. And if they're on the treadmill, the debt treadmill, they're forced to worship a buck because they got to make the payments.
It keeps you constantly. It's actually a good example, a good comparison we made. It's to the Whiskey Rebellion, it's the folks of the Mountain Men, because they had their own self-sustaining economy. And what did that economy do? It gave them a sense of themselves, and it allowed them a form of independence. And it became, and their currency was a part of their culture. It wasn't just a thing that you used to pay off debts and to. And to get power, it had a bonding element.
And it actually held value because it had calories in it.
it had a cultural value, which that matters a lot. Culture matters a lot. And if you can divorce human beings from that aspect, they're not going to have any cohesion. They're going to become atomized, and they're going to end up being at the whims of the almighty dollar at all times.
This is why if you debase the currency, you inevitably debase the culture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just inevitably going to be that way. And so the Hamiltonian system works perfectly in creating that, because what it does is it identifies the weaknesses inherent in liberalism, and thus makes it so that the power is accrued in one centralized place among you and a close group of friends, preferably ethnically related, I assume.
Yeah. And that is something that is a relationship that precedes the political class and familial kin relationships, these things, loyalty to a particular area, geographic area, the soil, blood and soil, if you will, if I may say. But that's been so pathologized in the 20th century.
Yeah, that thing, and this is something that Lash kind of touched upon in Revolt of the Elites. It divorces the elites from common people, because he notes that up until the 20th century, the WASP elites of this country felt duty bound in some way to to contribute to the public good. And he highlights the number of reasons for this, and main ones being like they had a sense of rootedness of where they were. So they felt duty bound to where they were from. Now they may still feel much higher and mightier or feel even different from the common folk, but because they are rooted in a sense of time and place, that they still have sympathy and affection for the place that they live in. They have a sense of self. And the new elites don't have that anymore because they become much more cosmopolitan. They become much more rootless. And they begin to despise the people that do have that for many number of reasons, not just because of that, but for many, many number of reasons, they begin to despise those people. And that's, I mean, to kind of answer your question, I think that you posed earlier is like, was this always going to inevitably be this way? Yes, if left alone, it was always going to end up like this. This is because like what you have in our society is what happens when you don't tell some people no, when you are incapable of when you're incapable of identifying the people who are accruing power and you're not capable of telling them no. This is inevitably what happens. But there was, I mean, despite the fact that the Jeffersonians that took power end up becoming kind of Hamiltonians in their own right, there was this, after the Civil War, there was this idea that we need to, and we had a problem with elites then as well, like the robber barons and like, but there was this idea we have to form an American nation. Like because we had so many disparate groups in this country, we have to form an actual nation here. And so there was this brief time period of a few decades, I'd say, maybe like 4 to 6 decades, and like kind of reaching its high point when we restricted immigration in, what was it, 1923?
24, yeah.
When we restricted immigration, is that we need to stop and we need to actually forge this nation now. And you can see that's why like the boomers are probably the last truly cohesive American generation in terms of a sense of Americanness to them. They were a product of that, and that was coming off the tail end of a victory high of a war. And so everything since then, since that high watermark, has been a decay in Americanness. Like, boomers can bemoan that there's no patriotic feeling or people don't know much about America anymore. It's because of what everything that came after, and you can't just make that happen because it happened.
And also the inertia carried out this by the demographics of 1965 made it appear sustainable. But it's interesting because I think you, FTN did a deep dive on Hart Celler and immigration and how Celler himself, a Jewish a congressman, waged a 40-year campaign to change the immigration laws. And he ultimately was successful. That's the type of determination that we're up against.
This is where the conservative, like, this is where, like, it's always funny to me, like, the way the conservatives like to taking the whole old national review line, like to envision themselves standing before history saying no. It's like, okay, you said no, but sometimes you gotta fight back. You have to actually pick up your weapons. And when the gunmen are coming for your door, you kind of need to fight back. You can't just keep telling them no.
Yeah.
All this metaphorically speaking.
But in the 20th century, in this, I guess, the Second World War played a big part of this, is how those groups interested in and diluting the American stock, the European stock, the founding stock of the country, were empowered, and they were able to, at least I think by the 1970s, gain a political ascendancy. Now we're engaged in a clear cultural war for the past 30, 40 years, again, to delegitimize the founding stock and sort of create a sentimental obligation just to allow for unrestricted immigration into the country, which will have a profound effect politically. It already has. And you mentioned the Bill of Rights, and there was an article written by UCLA professor Adam Winkler, this particularly on the gun issue, the Second Amendment. He wrote that the changing demographics, the browning of America, would inevitably result in support for the Second Amendment and other parts of the Bill of Rights eroding.
Yep. I mean, the whole purpose of why they're doing this is it, It's often framed in this, and I think even Mike, when he was on your show, was critical of this idea that, you know, is the idea that the way it's often phrased that Republicans won't win elections anymore. But the correct way to view all of this is that you have hostile elites that are basically importing and settling barbarian tribes in order to destroy what remains of the founding yeoman stock of this country.
Yeah,
to dismember and disempower them.
And it has become, I guess, I mean, there is debate about to the sense that white is an identity, as opposed to ethnicity. But even with the triple melting pot, Americans, you know, the various Germans, Italians, Irish, Scot-Irish, you know, French, they've become white Americans. At least they've been labeled as such. They suburbia created this, and now it's a question: can you coalesce, or can you organize on those lines to sort of fight back, create a certain identity? But the point is that they've identified it as whiteness as being evil. In fact, there was a video I saw today by Mercer. What's her name? Mm-hmm. Forget her first name. But she made the point.
Alana Mercer.
And she's Jewish.
Yep. I'm proud of her work.
She made an important point about how a lot of Republicans and conservatives will look at, you know, identity politics. They'll call it identity politics. But the point she made was that whether if you're American Indian or you're Asian American or you're black, that not going after other minorities, they're going after whites.
Yeah.
So it's the white majority that's on the chopping block for a very specific reason. And it's the reason that it's about destroying the founding American stock, because that's where the oligarchs find resistance, you know, to the New World Order plan. They want a bunch of, you know, rootless, you know, consumers of vague ethnicity, no identity. That's all part of it, you know.
The way I approach the whole thing about whiteness is because I understand the points that are made about that, but it's, you know, it's, you can't unring a bell. It's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
There's not going to be, there was a time, yes, where the immigrant ethnic identities were much stronger in America. And actually that's what the people who wanted to like forge this idea of an American nation, they wanted to actually get away from that, because that's always been a problem in this country. We've mm-hmm. always had that problem. The Irish were always an issue. They mm-hmm. were always creating problems. And it was like, how do we, because even though there's always been cultural differences between different regions of the country, there was still like this sense like, well, we're from similar stock, we're similar people. And there was not this division about that. But when these other ethnic and religious problems began to be imported into the country, and it got worse after the revolutions of the 1848s brought a lot more Europeans here, it became this necessity to have to actually forge this new ethnic group. Unfortunately, the problem was, and this is again like goes kind of back to the problem of American nationalism, because the American nationalism has been rooted historically as a civic nationalism. It has historically been a civic nationalism and has always downplayed the ethnic components of it. There was never, like, white Americans have never had this ethnic sense of self as strongly as other European stock people have. And you get into this problem of language games, basically, because race is a heuristic of understanding these much broader and easily recognizable differences in human beings. But because we never the thing is, we did have a term for the ethnic stock of this country, and the only problem is that it was never fully embraced and remained fungible. American. If you're a white person in this country, your ethnic group is American. Because the borders have... Yeah. The borders, the Afrikaner, I don't know why I pronounced it that way. I think it's like the borders, the Afrikaners, are their own ethnic group. Mm-hmm. They had a similar thing that they underwent. They're not Dutch. There's plenty of them that aren't ethnically Dutch in the least bit.
Yeah, you have to have descendants who took part in the Great Trek.
they were forged into their own ethnic group, and that's the same thing that happened here. There was actually for a while in 2016, 2017, there was a there was an attempt to try and get us to call ourselves Americaners, which I was actually I actually liked that term quite a bit. I was like, but and the other problem of why we couldn't use Americans is because of the black problem, because blacks have historically always been here and mm-hmm. have been their own, even at best in terms of American nationalism, they've always been a nation within a nation. That's always been a problem, and that was a problem that was never going to go away unless there was an actual separation. And since that never happened, that question always remained on the table. But to be white in this country, your ethnic group is just American, because there's, unless you maintain some truly deep ties to these immigrant countries, to the home country on all sides of your family, chances are you have been Americanized, and you just can't undo that, as much as you don't want to be lumped in with that.
This goes to the nature of America itself, which is problematic.
Yes, America's always been a problem. Freemasonic New World Order.
I mean, Brave New World, and it's an easier question. It is the ethnic or racial question in the European states, because they're traditional. Germans should be like Germans, you know. Italians should be like Italians, and they shouldn't. You know, Sweden should be inundated with. It's almost self-evident. It's absurd to have people from Somalia or Sudan being sent to Sweden. and the malevolence is obvious in that situation, you know.
And these little deconstruction and word games can be done with any ethnicity, especially Germans, because Germany wasn't a country until the 19th century. Yeah. Germans have historically been just an amalgamation of different types of tribes. Like, you mm-hmm. can keep breaking these down into their smallest components and trying to delegitimize the category in and of itself. But it's like I often say, like, don't argue against the idea of social constructions. Most things are social constructions, and that's a good thing. Why is that a bad thing?
It's like, so human beings are social animals, is their style. Yeah. And so, yeah, they can have social constructions. Yeah.
Well, there's the people like get tripped up by it because they think that there's this idea like, if it's social constructed, then it means it's illegitimate, because like it's tactical nihilism. It's tactical nihilism because it's like, well, then you can't really define it. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just an arbitrary category.
It's a way to deny legitimacy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not an arbitrary category, because we're social animals and it's legitimate to us. That matters. Like if sexual identities can be socially constructed and valid, then that necessarily follows that anything can be socially constructed and valid. It just matters who has the power and who does it mean, like, and does it have meaning for that group of people? If it has meaning, then it's a real thing. That's just simply how you transcend nihilism, is that it matters, and it has meaning because it matters to us, and it has meaning to us, and we matter. So,
and as far as the question of whiteness or white identity is, for the past the civil rights movement and sort of this concern about minority rights kicked in after the 1950s, in the 60s, into the 70s, it was sort of understood that the majority in power would be the European stock, the white Americans.
Yeah. And my favorite troll, and this is an absolutely true troll, my favorite way to troll liberals, if they ever bring up World War II, is that the white supremacists beat the Nazis.
Yes.
Because because that's literally what white supremacy is. Like, the founding stock gets to maintain its majoritarian status, and it shouldn't be threatened in any way.
And interesting enough, this was acknowledged, at least rhetorically, in Hart Celler, because there was Lyndon Johnson said this would not change the demographics. So even he, at least, gave lip service to that concern, that they were aware that demographics mattered. And now we look at it, and it's there's been a decline of, close to 90% down to 60, below 65%. There's obviously been a dramatic shift, and this has really picked up after the year 2000. So, they've been doing this, and we can talk about how they're doing this with NGOs and refugee relief and all these things, Jewish organizations, even infiltrating Catholic Charity and manipulating that for those purposes. But the assumption was that with the founding stock, the European, the white Americans kind of controlling the show and extending the benefits and privileges of American life to these minorities. But somewhere along the line, the rhetoric got shifted, and whiteness was pathologized or demonized. And now they're rhetorically lording over the inevitable decline of white American. Oh, just wait, you see what the politics will be. Oh, well, yeah. Then you're the one putting in those terms now. So you're forcing what remains of the white majority, it's still technically a supermajority, to respond to this. And so naturally, people who are noticing this are going to try to coalesce or organize, create identity, and organize politically. But now this is why you're seeing this whole thing about white supremacy being used. I was reading an article today about the New Jersey, Homeland Security. White supremacy alert, which is just so odd. What do they mean by that? Is there an organization? Are there individuals? Are they charged with anything? Have they committed any crimes? And they cite vague, I'm sure, ADL or SPLC stats about vandalism and things like that, which is usually perpetrated by the person who owns the property because they want to stir up the publicity and the funding that comes from that. And, these things always end up, 9 times out of 10 end up being hoaxes anyway, but the point is, this white identity becomes the boogeyman and not the crime. And now, so all of a sudden, the politics, which they can then describe as white supremacy, like opposing the destruction of Confederate statues, will mark you as a white supremacist. Yeah. That's a completely legitimate political standpoint. Or understanding that there's something that you may call white interest and organizing behind that, and all of a sudden you become a white supremacist as opposed to just someone who believes there's white interest. This is where you talk about the language being weaponized. I saw an article today, or a couple of days ago, and it was so weird to me. There was a young man who murdered his mother and younger brother, 6-year-old brother. And you read the article, apparently the article spelled the reason why he did this, and the father is the survivor. The reason why he did, and this is in the article, and that this is murder, mother and child murdered by the older brother, because he was supposedly dating a black girl, and they didn't like it. And the article goes, 9/10 of the article is about the family's racist attitudes.
It's because now that young man's a hero to them.
And I'm thinking, this guy just lost his, he's lost 2 sons, because his other son killed his other brother. There's a tragedy here, but the reading public is supposed to get enraged because they're racists.
Yeah, it's actually quite the language scheme that they pull is actually quite brilliant, because defending, when you take these actual definitions, they actually are aware of this, so they try to trap you this way, because defending the Confederate statues literally is white supremacy. The funniest thing is that for people who have probably very mild views when it comes to the demographics question, they might not be they may not be people who, they don't want to believe in an ethno state or anything like that. And they don't truck with get into fascism or national socialism or anything like that. They just want to maintain the demographics and a majoritarian status in this country. That is literally white. When you remove the emotion from these words, that literally is white supremacy.
That's important because Mr. Professor Winkler says that it does have political implications.
Why I'm saying this is because it's funny because when you remove how emotionally charged these words are, then there's nothing wrong with being a white supremacist. But the way that they do this is they play these word games where now what white supremacist is equated with I'm just going to drive around a neighborhood and just mindlessly run down minorities for no reason whatsoever, and I want to commit acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing. That's ends up being what they equate white supremacy to, or believing that white people are the master race. Mm-hmm. They play these little word games, and then when you actually know what the word what it means, and it allows them to flip the switch whenever they want, when all you want is to just maintain the demographics. That literally is white supremacy as well. That's the neutral, unemotional definition of it. But they can utilize both definitions because most people are not going to be smart enough to be able to parse that issue out. It's they're incredibly adept at playing at these high IQ, high verbal IQ word games, basically.
And if you were, maintain the demographics or reverse them, because as I mentioned earlier, when they signed Hart-Celler, they said it wouldn't change the country's demographics. Means that in order to get back to the demographics of 1965, you'd have to get back to a close to near 90% white majority, people of a European stock in the country. Does that mean the people who signed Hart-Celler with those promises, and I don't think they signed in good faith, but at least rhetorically, they were white supremacists because they were acknowledging that those demographic numbers mattered. Again, it was a question of bringing in the marginalized minority group to enjoy what white Americans had created and extending them those privileges and immunities and benefits and opportunities. But if you reverse the demographics, especially if you do it with mass immigration, You know, mass immigration is the worst thing because simply you don't have anything process of assimilation. You know, a minority and a majority group is going to be forced to accommodate the majority. When you have mass immigration like you do, there's no attempt to make those changes. And also, well, America's different circumstances. America, it just, even in Europe, the welfare states, which are somewhat sustainable under the, maybe, with a native population, they became, it becomes a pinata of goodies just to be, you know, kicked around and taken and fleeced. The system, it become, the system, everyone fleeces it. And, and that's, then we get back to how is this enabled? It's enabled through Hamilton's empire of debt.
Yeah. So. And this is why I get some flack for the way that I talk about the AQ, the America question, and the problems of American nationalism. And I often frame this in the way that the Turks had a similar problem when the Ottoman Empire was collapsing, because first they tried Ottomanism, which was trying to, which was literally civic imperialism. Mm-hmm. Then they tried, because the Turks actually had a very poor ethnic sense of self, and they ran away from that ethnic identity as much as possible because it implied, like, you know, nomads or dirt farmers or, like, you know, people out in the countryside. Like, the Ottomans were very, very much prided themselves on being cosmopolitan imperials, cultured cosmopolitan people. And so this idea of them being Turks was, had to be constructed for them. Then they tried Pan-Turanism, which attempted to unite all Turkic peoples from the Tatars in Crimea all the way out to, like, on the board, you know, on the borders of Central Asia Turks. And there was no way, like, all those Turks were ever going to identify with one another. They're just way too disparate. And so what ended up happening is that they had Turkishness imposed upon them when the Ottoman Empire was divided up and collapsed. There was population exchanges between Greece and Turkey as well later on, where because Turkishness was such a confused identity, they decided to just separate people based off of, it was a better idea to separate people based off of religion. So you had Greeks who were Muslims who ended up in Turkey, and you had Turks who were Christians who ended up in Greece, and they just decided to deal with it, like, just do it that way. But that's how Turkishness basically came into being in the 20th century, with a Turkic ethnic group finally consolidated. And so it's got, like, that's why you'll see across Turks a number of different phenotypes. You'll see a number of differences across them, because it had to be constructed. And I always bring this up because this is ultimately, like, this is the situation that America and Americans are going to be going into, because there's no, you're not going to find this magic formula that's going to get around these word games. If they construct these, just like Hamilton constructed power to, you know, work every which way for him, they construct these word games. So there's really no way for you to be able to ever go on the attack. You're always on the defensive, always looking for a way to avoid the most emotionally charged terminology that's used against you until the white yeoman stock of this country has a cohesive sense of themselves that's built in that it's a nationalism for themselves alone. It's not a nationalism that they share with the United States government. It's not a nationalism that they share with other groups. Like, this is like, we are identifying together as one with one another because we have this shared culture, we have this shared identity, we have these communities, we have this sense of self about ourselves, and this is for us and us alone. Until that happens, there's not going, like, it's going to be hard to oppose anything that this Hamiltonian system is doing, because it is a system that's predicated on dividing and conquering to keep people in debt slavery.
Yeah, and it's a liberal system, which is ultimately very illiberal because mm-hmm. It doesn't play by its own rules. As
yeah.
You know, it doesn't really tolerate free speech that matters. You know, it has many mechanisms of control and manipulation and suppression. And, you know, that whether it's, you know, a free press, which is controlled by a few corporations of interlocking directorates, that, which all have the same agenda, or it's the, you know, they can count on private intelligence outfits like the SPLC to hunt people down and harass them. And pay people because of they'll have donors willing to pay people to harass people to deprive troublesome people of a livelihood, so it can suppress mm-hmm. speech that way, you know. So, again, not to mention the fact that, again, the corruption of elections and how politicians are bought and campaign finance and foreign influence in the in American elections. And then I'm not talking about Russia, I'm talking about a much smaller country. So, I mean,
in Polynesia, of course.
Yeah. You know, and so it does, again, if you're taking a traditionalist or even a fascist critique of liberalism, is liberalism itself is illiberal. So it doesn't play by its own rules.
Yeah. You know? Carl Schmitt basically, basically blew liberalism out of the water, and it's never recovered. There's never, to my view, there's never been a credible, robust critique of Schmitt's critiques, or robust response to Schmitt's critiques. I mean, you try reading Rawls, and it's like, okay, dude.
So yeah,
you believe that.
He was the National Socialist legal theorist, right?
Yep. Yeah, traditional Catholic as well. I think he was kind of like more of like a reluctant National Socialist, but he was an astounding jurist who drew deeply upon his Catholic tradition.
And oddly enough, has ties to the neoconservatives, at least.
Because he had correspondence with Leo Strauss.
Leo Strauss, yeah. The Straussians at Chicago University. Yeah, so. Yeah, so that's interesting. So, listen, I've had you over two hours.
Yeah. One last thing I'll say, and this will kind of sum up the problem of why what it means to be an American has always been a problem that existed, because we didn't even have a name. We didn't even have an agreed upon name for ourselves. This place was just called the Colonies. That's mm-hmm. That's what we were called for the longest time. We were just the Colonies. And so once the Colonies were freed, then what are we? And that's the question that we as Americans have for the last 250 some years have been trying to answer for ourselves with various successes and failures. And that's for us, as things go on for our struggle, that's going to be ultimately the question that needs to be answered.
Yeah. And up until the 1860s, it was the United States are.
Yep.
Then it became the United States is. So. Maybe to get back to something more functional, we should correct the grammar there, and we get a better idea of how the country should be governed and functioned. You know,
mm-hmm.
Decentralized. You know, at the very least, and not so ambitious. You know, of course, that's not. You know, it's a vessel that's been taken over by forces, cosmopolitan international forces, as all empires usually are. So, you know. So, well, listen, so I'll let you go. I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me back on. We can talk about my writing next time.
Yeah,
I got a new piece coming out soon about environmentalism on the right and Pentti Linkola and his biography. So.
Okay. And, Chris, Alex and Hamilton, the deep dive, you can listen to that at the rightstuff.biz.
Yeah, I think the first part of it is called, because I had a really American Mephistopheles.
Right? Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I was very proud of that one. I coined that one.
American Mephistopheles. So sorry, yep. I talked over you. And is that behind the paywall, or is that?
That's yeah. So the all these deep dives are always paywalled.
Okay, so,
and so our little gift to the subscribers that we do this research for them.
So I got the opportunity to listen to it, and it's a great, you know, it's about 4.5 hours total.
Maybe. Yeah, it's about accurate.
It's a lot of information, and you know, we kind of touched on it. There's more, obviously, more information in those two programs than we can provide here. So I urge people to go there and give it a listen. And I'll let you go. And so, to follow your work, do you have any specific sites or anything? Or
I have a blog I sometimes write at called raceboors.com, RaceBorz.com. I actually just posted a translation of a Linkola biography on there. Currently, there's a Twitter account that people might want to check out. Who knows how long that's going to last? It's called Boomer Chang.
Okay.
And then, of course, I'm John Chat. Like, in case people are looking for my works and can't find where's Borzoi, and it's like, well, I'm John Chapman on The American Sun. That's not my real name. That's actually the name of Johnny Appleseed. That was my little that's my little way of paying homage to the folk traditions of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because as much as people like to, some people like to paint me as anti-American, I'm just anti-American government. I have a deep love and deep love because I'm from the. I'm descended from the colonists, partially descended from colonists who fought for their independence. I have a deep, abiding love for the yeoman spirit of this country, and that's what I wanted to pay my respects to.
Yeah, whenever I get that, someone tells me, you know, you're anti-American. I says, well, that ain't my America, buddy.
Yeah.
So okay, thank you so much. I'll let you go. I'll post as soon as I do. I'll send you the link.
All right, sounds good.
Great, thank you so much. Bye-bye. Good night.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Seen before.